This is Glenn Hughes, and I'm talking rock and roll with Dave and Shane.
Oh, my God.
We've got the voice of rock on right now, Mr. Glenn Hughes. No one has that soul. No one has that tone. And one mighty rockin' bassist as well. Glenn Hughes is performing the 50th anniversary of Deep Purple's Burn live. And this is huge. And Glenn, does this take you back to the first day that you joined the mighty Deep Purple with the great David Coverdale?
Yeah, I mean, it was, it's quite alarming how long it's been. And as I look back through the decades of love and everything, it's remarkable that some of us are still here to tell the tale. So I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah.
Do you, while you're doing this, do you kind of miss having David by your side doing some of these songs?
Yeah, David's one of my best friends. As you can hear on the album, we really enjoyed that vocal duet we had. You know, we had a remarkable time doing that. And, you know, I'm sure we would all love to do something together. It hasn't worked out because of scheduling these days. It's impossible, but I'm doing well on my own, you know. I really been enjoying doing it.
Talk about those early days working with Richie. You've worked with so many great guitar players. I know you said he was quite the prankster. What was it like working with him as a writer, and what was his personality like?
Let's address the prankster thing first. I mean, you know, behind the scene, when you're working with someone like that, it's fun. You know, but in general, the image that Blackmore portrays, I think he wants people to see that dark side of him, you know. But behind closed doors, he really isn't that way really at all, you know. He's quite considerate and kind, you know. So I think he's playing the actor role quite well.
Was he ever obsessed with your hair? I have to ask. We talked to Joe Lynn about that. Graham, we talked to Graham about that.
I never really spoke. I really shouldn't say this, but when I joined the band, I was 21, you know, I had very thick hair, and I'm lucky I still do. I think a couple of guys in Deep Purple said to me, you know, well, you know, you'll be the next to lose your hair, you know. So I just was very fortunate that I haven't been able to lose my hair. So, yeah.
So, Glenn, we have a listener, Dave Mann from Silver Spring, Maryland. He wanted to know, what made Richie Blackmore different than any other musician you've worked with, and was he difficult?
Let's talk about early 70s rock guitar players. In my opinion, I think the whole... Now, listen, this is rock guitar players now. I'm talking about early 70s. The Holy Trinity of hard rock guitar players would have been Page, Blackmore, and Iommi.
Yeah.
Now, we all know there are other great guitar players like Jeff Beck and Carlos Santana, you know, and Gary Moore, but the Holy Trinity in that period would have been Blackmore, Iommi, and Page. Do you agree?
No,
absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What? Was it different working with Tony? Like, did they have different styles, like working with Tony Iommi?
Well, personally, Tony's one of my closest friends, and he has been for 5 decades.
Yeah.
Working with Tony is so easy. There's no restriction, and it's quite easy for me to do. And I think he feels the same way. With Richie, it was different because Richie is an isolator. And as you can imagine, but you're asking me questions, I have to be careful how I answer.
Yes. Yeah, we don't want to get you in trouble.
No, not at all. I don't think I could get in trouble anymore, you know.
One would hope not after all these years.
No.
Yeah. Well, the Seven Star Project, a beautiful album that you did with Tony. It was originally a solo album. It ended up becoming a Sabbath album featuring Tony in 1986. Were there additional sessions for that record? Were there anything that ended up on Fuse? Is there stuff that's still in the can that you would like to see released? A deluxe version, perhaps?
On Seventh Star, I don't know if you guys know, but that was initially supposed to be a Tony album.
Yep.
And he called me up. And I think it's very fair to say that he called Ronnie too. And he may have called Rob Halford too, all three of us to do this, you know, vocalize on Tony's solo album. So when I went down to the studio on the very first day, I was the first singer to go down there. The songs started coming out immediately, and I ended up singing the whole album. So again, it was a solo album for Tony, hence it's a slight different left turn curve on Seventh Star. And Warner Brothers and Don Arden, Sharon's father, decided they would call it Seventh Star, you know, featuring Tony Iommi, Black Sabbath. So that's the story.
How did you feel when you heard your voice on a record that had the Black Sabbath name on it? I mean, I know that quote. You said it was like James Brown singing in Metallica. It's just you weren't
right.
Feeling
it. Right. You know, fellas, truly now, I'm not a metal singer. Look, we all know that. I'm a rock soul singer. We all know that.
Right.
Yeah. Tony wanted me to come in and help him out. And I've known Tony since 1970. So when he asked me to come down to the studio, I did that, you know. Again, we didn't think it was going to be Sabbath, so we didn't really make it a dark album, really. It's very melodic, isn't it? So,
yeah.
But, you know, look, I love all kinds of music. I mean, literally, as you know me well, I love it all.
Yeah.
So for me to appear with Tony on a Black Sabbath album was okay, actually.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite records. I mean, that and Fused. Oh, my God. I was hoping that someday we'll have another Fused record, right, Shane?
Let me give you a quick story about Fused. The album was recorded, I think, in 2006. And if you guys can remember, shortly after we made the album, and Tony and I were going to do a promo tour of, you know, talking to the press in Europe, Sharon put the reunion back together. Mm. So the Fuse and also Geezer's album were shelved. They came out, as you know, but they weren't heavily promoted because Sabbath were doing a reunion. Now, this was not good news for Tony and I and Kenny Aronoff, because we were going to go out and do a lot of shows in the States and Europe behind Fused. So when I look back at the Fused release, which was very minimal, as you know, people talk about it being such an iconic album, but it was never given the legs to do that. So I have unfinished business with Tony, you know. So.
Yeah.
Where did you see Deep Purple going musically if you would have followed up Come Taste the Band? Where do you think Deep Purple would have gone?
You know, fellas, when you talk about Purple, you had me and David come in, and then Tommy. Then it was three new guys,
and John
and Ian. The band had changed so much when Richie left. Mm. It had made a real left turn. Where would we have been if Tommy number one would have survived?
Yeah.
I think it would have been further away than Come Taste the Band. I think we were all in the summer of 75 when we made Come Taste the Band, as a five men, we were really enjoying this expedition we were on. But it was definitely taking it away from a Mark II sound.
Yeah.
So it was going in a different direction, as you know.
When Tommy, go ahead, Shane, go ahead, please.
No, Tommy was starting to get, I mean, his work ethic was crazy, and he was playing a lot of fusion at that point. Do you think that would have probably worked its way into your sound?
You know something, and this, I've never spoke about this before. I think the band Deep Purple in itself, after Come Taste the Band, I don't really know where we were going. Because I came in with this time around and getting tighter, as you know, and you keep on moving. And it was a different – look, they're great songs.
Oh, yeah.
But was it classic Deep Purple? Or were we reinventing the band again? So people always ask me, wouldn't it have been great for you and Tommy to continue? Yeah, but I don't think it would have really worked with Deep Purple.
Yeah. When Richie left, I mean, was it just like, holy shit, what do we do now? You know, I mean, or was the tension, I mean, I guess the tension was kind of building for a little while.
Oh, no, look, when we started making Stormbringer, Richie brought in only two songs, which were Stormbringer, the music of Stormbringer, and Soldier of Fortune. And he didn't bring any musical ideas other than that. And that's the first time in Deep Purple's history where he had no songs. Whether he was thinking about leaving then, I know he was thinking about leaving towards the end of the album. He didn't tell us, but we went on and made the album, you know, kind of without Richie being present. And I say that with respect, because I thought Richie played remarkably well on Stormbringer.
Mm. Absolutely.
Going back to Tommy, because I find Tommy fascinating. You recently said some very loving things about him, being one of the most underrated guitarists. I would agree with you on that. Well, I think a lot of people would. How important was Tommy to you personally? I know you guys were very close, but he has such an incredible catalog of stuff with Billy Cobham, Zephyr, James Gang, Moxie. He did some stuff with Moxie, Deep Purple, of course.
Yeah.
What?
I was familiar with Tommy from Spectrum. The Billy Cobham, and I fell in love with his playing before I met him. So when I met Tommy on the audition, it's a famous story. When I walk in the room, I saw this guy with green, red, and purple hair. I walk up and said, "If you don't get the gig, you're coming home with me anyway." He got the gig. He came in and moved into my home for a while. We became very, very good friends. We're the same age. Leo was born in the same month. We were inseparable, as you know. I genuinely, dearly, sincerely miss him more than you can imagine to this very, very day. Because he was, in my opinion, one of the most iconic guitar players that ever lived.
Yeah. It's amazing how Deep Purple's kind of like this family tree in a way, you know. I mean, there's so many people connected to the band or around the band, and I didn't realize until I saw a recent interview, actually I think it might have been a few years ago, where you talked about how it was around those early years you also met Ronnie James Dio. Like, can you talk about the story, how you met Ronnie and kind of what you thought about Ronnie?
Well, Ronnie was opening for Deep Purple in 74. I think the first shows were in the UK. I had never heard of Elf, so I was on the side of the when there's an opening band, I'm normally on the side of the stage, and on they go, and first of all, I'm in the dressing room, I'm hearing this band with this huge vocalist, so I go up side of the stage, and I see a diminutive-looking band, not tall gentlemen, which made me think, well, how can that voice come out of that small frame? when Ronnie came off stage, I went over to him and we went to my dressing room and we became very fast friends. And he was my friend for my whole life. You know, we were inseparable again. He was, when he left Rainbow, he moved, to live in Los Angeles, to be closer to where I lived, and him and Wendy, and we were very, very, very good friends and very close, very close.
Yeah. Was it when you sang, you did tributes for Ronnie and stuff, when you were singing his stuff, I mean, how emotional was that for you to do with such a good friend?
Well, Ronnie loved my work, as I think you know that, and I absolutely loved his. We did do things together privately, and we jammed a lot at my house, and we were together quite a lot, and there would have been a point at some point, even towards the end of his life, we spoke about doing something. Mm-hmm. Look, there's only a few people I can say this about, but we will look, you know, I loved his voice, and we just loved, we loved to laugh. Ronnie was a comedian. He was really funny. Yeah, he was an incredible human being.
Yeah. I know you're talking about the Holy Trinity of, Paige, Iommi, and Blackmore. Wanted to get your thoughts. I know you worked closely with Gary Moore. The Run for Cover album is one of my favorite records. Absolutely. I guess two-part question. Talk about working with the late, great Gary Moore. And then also, can we ask you about Bernie Marsden, who just passed, sadly?
Two good things to talk about. Let's, number one, talk about Bernie, first of all, because we just lost him.
Yeah.
I've known Bernie from right before he joined Whitesnake. So, as we all know, he was a very good man, and he wrote great music and a great guitar player. He joined me in my show about 5 years ago in Kiev, and he was amazing. A true scholar and a wonderful human being, and I really do miss him.
Mm.
With Gary and I had put Summer together in 1979. I was a big Skid Row fan, the original Skid Row, as you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He was a big trapeze fan, and we were, again, I've met a few people, we spoke about them already, that were close to me. I have to say this to you, and I hope this gets a lot of coverage. Gary Moore, in my opinion, this may shock people or not, was possibly the greatest guitar player I've ever played with.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow.
And by the way, you know I've played with them all.
Yeah.
Yes,
oh,
you
yeah.
did.
You know, yeah.
What makes you say that? Was it just, were you just dumbfounded when you were working with them? Just.
Again, I like to work with people at home or in the studio privately. And when I'm sitting next to somebody and they're playing, I watch and listen and learn. And I'm watching Gary play constantly, effortlessly, in any genre of anything he wanted to do. And he was fluid in everything he did. Fluid, yeah. Fluid, fluid. And he was absolutely criminally, insanely, the most underrated guitar player ever. And I want people to know how good he was. And still is, you know.
He was so versatile. The versatility just is mind-blowing.
The most aggressive playing guitar player on the fretboard. I mean, he had the heaviest strings, and he could bend and bend. He had no fear of the next note that he was going to play.
I was blessed to see him on the Corridors of Power tour in the U.S. He played, I think it was with Rat and somebody else, I can't remember, but he stole the show.
Listen, you talk to any band that Gary opened for, they'll tell you the same. You the same. I'm talking about him like this now because as I look back over on my life of playing with certain people, I get questions all the time. But it's really coming into my mind and heart how much I miss him as a person, but how incredibly talented he was.
Yeah. Just incredible. And you know, as time goes on and we lose, you know, more and more icons, I mean, what is it? You know, what goes through your mind? I mean, these are your peers, you know? I mean, what does it make going, playing these stages, playing these shows like you're doing on this Byrne 50th anniversary celebration, does it make it more important, more personal for you?
Well, it makes it personal. It doesn't make it more important because I'll tell you why, because we are losing people left, right, and center.
Mm.
And when you talk about Byrne 50, it's like it feels like ancient and it feels... But listen, fellas, my peer group, I'm sure that your peer group as well, I guess I'm older than you, but not, I don't know how much. My peer group are disappearing, if you will.
Mm.
either sick or just disappeared from the music scene, or they are passing away or decided to retire, the numbers are getting smaller. And in 10 years' time, there'll be none of the classic rockers from the 70s left, or they'll be retired, or they'll be deceased. So I am in that brigade of continuing this road of happy destiny while I'm still healthy enough to do it. That's why I'm doing the legacy show right now. I'm doing this for another 18 months. And when I close this chapter, I'll do something else.
Mm. Yeah. Black Country Communion. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Please.
Please, please. For now.
I finished it 2 weeks ago with Joe. The album is complete. We are mixing in the next 2 months. The album will be released in the first quarter of 2024.
Oh my God!
Awesome.
This has made my day.
Yeah, my one last goal is such a jam. The whole record is a jam. I cannot wait. Oh my gosh!
Thank you,
Glenn. Is it nice to see bands like Judas Priest finally make it into the Hall of Fame? I know you said you're not metal, but you play an important role in hard rock and metal.
You think
metal and hard rock have been way too ignored by the mainstream rock industry? I mean, Thin Lizzy's not in, Dio's not in, Motorhead's not in.
No, first of all, let me make something quite clear. I'm not metal, but I'm surrounded by metal people. I mean, I'm not a metal-looking, sounding dude. I mean, I leave that up to Rob Halford, one of my oldest friends. I love Rob to pieces. And when I look at metal, I look at the iconic status of the way they look, the way they sound. That's metal to me.
Yeah.
So, hard rock and metal are two amazing fan bases of great followers, you know. So for me, being around these friends of mine, I know the guys, of course, in Priest and Maiden and blah, blah, blah. So it's interesting. And I'm glad for Rob and the guys and Glenn, of course, that they made it to the Hall of Fame. And I really believe, although they don't want to be included, I believe Maiden will be included in the next couple of years.
Yeah, it's got to be. What's it like for you, you know, to see younger bands out there kind of, you know, following, I mean, no one can follow your footsteps specifically, but, you know, but taking, kind of trying to try in their own shoes and walking their own path while taking so much inspiration from you vocally and as a bassist and everything. What does that feel like?
Repeat the question, please.
What does it feel like to see so many young artists kind of, you know, following your inspiration?
Oh, yeah.
You know, influenced by your voice, your bass playing, and that new generation of rock. How does that feel?
It's nice. I mean, I meet some younger artists that you probably know that have been touched by my work, if you will. And again, I'm in a place in my life where I've been living somewhat of a spiritual experience the last 30 years, so everything has changed for me. So for me to meet newer, younger artists that are working to create something special, I'm a big, big candidate to give them a lot of respect. Because rock and roll, the rock and roll industry is not like it used to be in the 70s. It's really hard to have any kind of success whatsoever these days. So I applaud anyone that wants to get in there and get dirty and get it done.
Just a quick follow-up. You talked about Watt. You didn't talk about it, but could you talk about working with Watt at the very beginning? I mean, he's going to be a monster producer and everything. What were those early days like with him? How did you meet him?
I met him at the Sunset Market at our friend Julian Lennon's party. And Andrew sent me a couple of songs, and I was completely blown away with, number one, his songwriting. I mean, he's absolutely astonishingly good songwriter. So he came over to my house and my studio, and we wrote two or three songs, and we looked at each other, and we said, let's go make some demos. And I said, well, Jason will be here next week. And we called Jason, and we went into a studio in LA, and we started making demos. And the next thing I know, we're with Dave Cobb in Nashville making an album.
Wow.
So it was interesting. And by the way, I knew right from the start that Andrew would go on to do remarkable things. Yeah. And I'm really happy for him. He's really, really done well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there anything you can add to the stuff you're doing with Joe and the album coming out next year? Is there any sound or any feel that that record's going to have that's different from the band's other records?
I use the word left turn a lot here. There's really no left turn with Backcountry. I mean, we are making album number 5 in the same way we made the first 4. We've written up my home again, made in about 10 days as normal. It's a continuation of the first 4. Again, if you have enjoyed the work on the first 4, there's a good, really, I think you'll really enjoy this next one. Joe and I wrote all the songs at my home in about 5 or 6 days, and they came together really well.
Wow. I know that you have a 2017 tour edition of your autobiography, Deep Purple and Beyond, Scenes from the Life of a Rock Star. Is there any plans to add to that or any plans for another book from you?
At some point I will do that. I just need to live some more life first. I mean, it was 11 years ago since I wrote the book. A lot has happened since then, trust me. So, but I will wait a little while and continue at some point.
Yeah. Through all of what you do, how do you take care of your voice? I mean, it's pristine, you know, after all these years. How do you do that? Is there a secret? If so, you don't have. I wouldn't ask you to divulge it, but it's got to be.
No.
It's amazing.
I say this with love here. I sleep quite a lot, which is important. If you're a singer and you have the vocal cords, you have to rest them. They're a muscle. You need vocal rest. I do extensive warm-ups before the show and then a sound check. And then before I go on stage, I'll do 3 or 4 songs in my dressing room, like real. And then I drink a lot of water. But the most important thing is this. When I'm at the microphone, I walk through any fear I have of anything. I don't take anything onto the stage. I don't take any issues. I walk on. I don't think about the next note. I'm just opening my chords and singing. I don't think about it. I just walk up there and just get in the moment. If I stay in the moment, my best meditation of all is singing. It's the most therapeutic way for me to survive.
Yeah. You were recently at the Landis in Vineland, and there's some video clips out there from your New Jersey show on the 16th of August. Absolutely just mind-blowing how natural it comes to you and how you sound. I mean, do you feel like your voice, as you get older, you're getting stronger? Or where do you stand on that with aging? And singing, you feel like you've got more bluesy, deeper, more soulful?
We were talking about this last night, my guitar player and myself. I feel, and he feels, that my voice at this present moment, I'm laughing because I hope nothing happens. I think at this present moment in time, on this particular tour, my voice has never been so strong. And my chords are really great right now. A lot of shows, I'm doing a lot of work. But right now, I am so grateful to be able to sing the way I'm doing right now because I'm so grateful.
Yeah. Yeah, the fans are just, I mean, if you haven't, if people haven't seen you live to catch this show, I mean, it's a must. You got to catch this tour because, I mean, your voice is just, it's phenomenal. And I love how there's so many different works. And I don't know how you do it all. I mean, you know, so many different projects at one time, it feels like over the years. It's amazing.
Yeah. I'll slow down at some point.
Well, I had to ask you this follow-up because there was an interesting thing that came out. You chatted with Eddie Van Halen, and, of course, it made news. How serious did it get with that whole thing? I mean, were you guys even at the rehearsal stage, or it was just talk?
No.
And
no. just so you know, in 1978, I spent Thanksgiving with Ozzy, Tony, Geezer, and Bill in Dallas, mm-hmm. Texas, doing a show. And they had an opening band called Van Halen. I didn't know who they were. Again, I found myself on the side of the stage watching the opening band, not heard a note of Van Halen. I was blown away by the band, but especially the young guitar player.
Yeah.
Eddie's, Van Halen's manager, Noel Monk, was my tour manager in Trapeze in 1972.
Wow.
So when Eddie came off the stage, Noel Monk introduced me to Eddie, and Eddie again and I became very good friends. And over the course of the years of Eddie's life, we would get together. I was at his house in the early 90s, and he told me at dinner they were thinking about, they had a number of names when Roth left. And I was one of them, and they were thinking about asking me, but they chose Sammy. So it was an interesting scenario that Eddie was thinking about my voice, and, you know, it was a wonderful moment for me.
What was that like to be on that conversation? What was that?
Well,
like?
You know, look, I'm Glenn, you know, from Deep Purple, and I think Eddie loved the Burn album. He liked Trapeze, as you know. So for me to be, you know, replacing Roth is not easy. He's such a front man. So I think Eddie liked the tone of my voice, you know.
Yeah.
So I never thought twice. Look, it was a real kick in the pants to get for Eddie to think that way. But it was a nice gesture from him.
Yeah. Were you a fan of Sammy and Montrose, you know, and Sammy?
I've known Sammy since Montrose. I've known Sammy since 1969.
Wow.
I've known all those guys, as you can imagine. So I've been around the longest. But, yeah, I'm a friend of all these people we're talking about. So, again, I'm a different man than I used to be. So I'm really happy.
Yeah. You know, talking about Trapeze, I mean, that was one of those early sort of breakthroughs when I think just, you know, going back listening to Trapeze, you know, it was like, wow, you know, you saw all the magic that's happened later in your career. We can see it in the Trapeze stuff and hear it. And it's so amazing. What was the writing like in Trapeze? What was that nucleus like for you all?
It was great. Mel and I, the guitar player, were so close. But with Trapeze, he wrote his songs with his brother.
Mm.
And I write my songs alone. I don't know how it ever got to that point where we were teenagers, but he decided he was going to write his songs with his brother. And I would write. If you look at all the Trapeze albums, you'll notice it was his songs and it was my songs, but never really together. We only wrote one song together. So it was an interesting situation.
Glenn, you're also a success story with sobriety. You kicked in November 23rd, 1997. What would you say to people out there about addiction? You know, any words of wisdom to people that may be listening?
For me, I had to get real and I had to get honest. I had to, number one, desperately need to get help. I tried to do it alone. It was impossible. I work well with others. I still do. So for me, to finally surrender on that day, 1997, I had been sober in 91, but I had a few more cocktails to do between 91 and 97. Not very many, but that's what I had a few more parties to go to. And then when I got sober in 97, I changed my whole lifestyle. I changed everything. And that was the key for me to, I didn't want to live that way anymore. I wrote songs about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the album Addiction was 1996, right?
I wrote about my addiction on that album, about how I wrote the song, I Don't Want to Live That Way Again. If you look and listen to those words, it was scary for me because how many people have we lost because they didn't have the ability to surrender?
Yeah.
And you've gone on to write even greater stuff. So, I mean, that you said that before in your book and stuff. You, somebody said to you someday, you know, you're gonna go on to write better songs because of this, and you feel like you've accomplished. You've obviously accomplished so much since then.
Yeah. I don't write about fiction. I write about the healing of the human condition between people on planet Earth. I haven't written since I got sober in 91, I never wrote fiction songs again. I've only been writing about the healing power of the human condition, about planet Earth, the humans here. You know, so that's what I write about.
Yeah, it's amazing. Your last album, too, Resonate, was just looking, it's 2016. And I apologize if you mentioned this earlier, but are you thinking about another solo album at some point, or...?
If I have got something to say, I'll record another album. It's been 7 or 8 years since the last one. I believe that I will make another one next year. Because I think I'm going to have something to say. You know, I'm smiling because I do have a lot more to say. So I probably will make another album, yeah.
Yes. Cannot wait.
We've been asking everybody about this, Glenn. Does AI, artificial intelligence, and songwriting, does that kind of piss you off that may be implemented and utilized in your industry?
It upsets me because a lot of people are going to lose money because we're going to be seeing all these images of people that are not them, and hearing. You can take anybody's voice now and do that. So a lot of people are going to lose money. I'm talking about people that are starting out, young bands, you know. I don't like it, but look, fellas, we have to embrace the future. We can't live in the past.
Yeah.
We gotta look, it's all these things are happening. We thought would never happen. That's all happening because it's supposed to happen.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Kind of a similar note, but like when bands use like backing tapes and things like that, and I know there's that debate kind of going on there. Where do you kind of fall on that whole issue?
I think in general with backing tracks, I think some music is okay. You know, some bands have been doing backing tracks, not vocally, for years. I think that's sort of okay, but with vocals, I'm not going to go with it. You can't be having people pay to see somebody lip sync.
Right.
It's just not fair, you know. And by the way, a lot of fans are doing it that you probably don't know are. And it's just horrifying.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Glenn.
I can't name names.
Yeah. Some people have, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, David Coverdale talked to us about this greatly. He it really fires him up, and it's something that, you know, he even stepped away from a tour because his voice has to be just so in order for Whitesnake and his name to go back out on stage. Do you feel like if you got to that point, you would just call it quits and you would walk away?
For me, if I have a fear, look, I don't send a message to the universe that something is wrong. I think people in general, if they aren't living appropriately, if they aren't in the good headspace, if their mind's chattering, if they feel there's an ailment in the body, then they'll think they're going to get sick. They'll get sick. I don't want to get sick. I work diligently every day, keeping myself in a good space. For me, to the word retire is when I'm done. I don't think I'm ever going to be done, but for me to slow down, it's really slowing down. I don't, if I stop, I won't be able to start again. I can't take 6 months off. The Dead Daisies wanted to take 6 months off and I refused. That's why I kept going. So I'm going to keep going until a moment in time when I'm going, I need to slow down.
You're like Sammy Hagar. You're just like Sammy. He keeps it going and going. I love that. Oh, man.
I've got a lot of energy for an older chap. So I'm going to keep doing this while I'm in good headspace, good vocal space, and good shape.
Please do. Long live Glenn Hughes. Oh, my gosh. Long live the output and the great music. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Is there anything else either anyone would like to add? I mean,
just let everybody know how grateful I am to still be here, and I'm looking forward to seeing you soon, everybody.
Wow.
Glenn, go see Glenn.
Yes, see Glenn.
Thank you. Have a good day, everyone.
Hey, everybody. This is Joel Linter. Hi, everybody. This is Rob Halford.
Rudy Sargent.
Hey, this is Steve Hackett.
You folks, this is Rick Emmett of Triumph, and we're talking rock with Dave and Shane.
Oh!